Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of why, in spite of an insurmountable advantage in money, the Republican Romney-Ryan ticket continues to be wrong-footed by gaffes which distract the campaign from its main message. Michelle Goldberg, a senior contributing writer to Newsweek and The Daily Beast, joins us to discuss how lucky Barack Obama appears to be in terms of candidates he has run against. Then we will speak with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, a former presidential advisor and a special advisor to the Department of Defense's Special Operations Command, about the president's red line in Syria regarding chemical weapons and their possible use. He has an article at The Huffington Post, "Obama's Syrian Red Line is No Red Light to Hezbollah or Iran." Then finally, we will speak with Robert Naiman, who back in June delivered a letter signed by Michael Moore, Oliver Stone and Noam Chomsky and others to the Ecuadorian embassy in London, urging Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa to approve Julian Assange's request for asylum. We will discuss the WikiLeaks founder's current predicament and the questions that Robert Naiman feels the press aren't asking, principally whether Assange's extradition to Sweden will lead to his extradition to the United States. Now is Michelle Goldberg, who's a senior contributing writer for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and is the author of the New York Times bestseller Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, and The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, winner of the 2008 J. Anthony Lucas Work in Progress Award and the Ernesto Drinker Ballad Book Prize. Michelle Goldberg's work has appeared in Glamour, Rolling Stone, The Nation, New York Magazine, The Guardian in the UK, and The New Republic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Goldberg.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And it seems that the Republican Party, they're being embarrassed about Congressman Aiken's outburst and his display of a combination of misogyny and ignorance. But nevertheless, they're enshrining his attitudes and views in their platform ahead of the Republican convention in Tampa. So I'm kind of confused.
Well, partly one of the reasons why they're so embarrassed by Todd Aiken's outburst is because he made views that they hold but kind of want to deflect attention from. He put those views at front and center. So there's kind of two parts to this. I mean, on the one hand, nobody at any point in the political spectrum, except for maybe Brian Fisher at the American Family Association, wants to defend his crazy idea about the kind of, you know, about the female body's miraculous power to deflect pregnancy in the event of rape. But this controversy is about more than just his kind of misbegotten notions about reproductive biology. It's also about his belief that women who do become pregnant as a result of rape should be forced to carry those pregnancies to term. And that is the normative view of the Republican Party. It's not Mitt Romney's view, but it is Paul Ryan's view. And I think more significantly, it is the view that's being enshrined in the 2012 Republican Party platform. So a lot of the reason that the party is so eager to push Aiken out of the race is because he's drawing attention to views that many in the party actually hold, but that they know are unpopular and that people would react badly to if they were more widely understood.
And they also want to win a Senate seat in Missouri.
Well, yeah, certainly, that's right. But I also, that is certainly correct. But the kind of vehemence with which they're trying to get rid of him, I think it's about more than just trying to win the Senate seat. You know, as is their threat to kind of withhold all this money if he stays in. It'll be really interesting to see what happens if he does stick around, how long they'll be able to, or they'll be willing to abide by that pledge.
Well, what's interesting, it seems, Michelle Goldberg, is that he's really calling the party on this division between the Tea Party and the sort of traditional Republicans, and he is actually being faithful to the Tea Party, which has always been essentially a Republican front, hasn't it, for the Republican right. So in digging his hole and digging his heels in, he's more or less saying, I'm principled and I'm not going to change my views and I'm surprised that people like Sarah Palin aren't sticking by him, frankly, because he's an exemplar of the Tea Party.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Sarah Palin's not sticking by him. I mean, certainly you see people like Sean Hannity was basically begging him to get out of the race. At the same time, I think there is a degree of grassroots support for him. I mean, the major anti-abortion organizations are sticking by him. I interviewed a couple of people today, anti-abortion activists who are furious with the party for trying to kind of push him out of the race. You know, I've been monitoring his webpage all day, and so earlier today he said, you know, kind of show the party, you know, basically, you know, stand up to the party bosses, donate today. And he had a goal of $24,000 in 24 hours. A little while ago, that hit $29,000, and they changed the goal to $100,000 by midnight, which suggests to me that the money's coming in.
Again, I'm speaking with Michelle Goldberg, as a senior contributing writer for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. And Michelle, you have written about the idea that women cannot conceive during rape, which has been advanced by conservatives for some decades. What have you discovered in this peculiar kind of underground, bizarre anti-science literature?
Well, to me, what's interesting is that the idea really seems to originate, I mean, it possibly originates in medieval times, right? There's a very old belief from hundreds of years ago that women needed to have an orgasm in order to conceive. But more recently, it seems to originate, or if not originate, to have been kind of set down by a guy named John Wilkie, who's one of the founders of the National Right to Life Committee, a very influential person in the anti-abortion movement. In fact, in 2008, Mitt Romney sought and received his endorsement and kind of touted him as a major pro-life surrogate. But what's interesting is that the in this article that John Wilkie wrote, kind of explaining the biological reasons that women kind of couldn't get pregnant or are very unlikely to get pregnant in the event of genuine trauma, he urges all anti-abortion activists to not to use the term rape by itself, but to always use the term forcible rape or assault rape. And he wants to do that for two different reasons. One, to differentiate it from statutory rape, which can just, you know, be having consensual sex with someone who's underage. But he also wants to differentiate it from women who just kind of claim rape after they become pregnant. You know, so he makes a case that, you know, kind of we can't believe the rape statistics, because while some people may underreport rape, there's also people who claim that they've been raped after they become pregnant for consensual sex. So what's interesting is that there is this kind of, you know, decision to use the term forcible rape, which again implies that there are kind of lesser types of rape, and also I think implies a certain suspicion of women who say that they've been raped. And the reason this is significant, of course, is, well, twofold. One, because, you know, Aiken later said that when he talked about legitimate rape, he really meant to use the term forcible rape. But beyond that, you know, forcible rape is a term that that Paul Ryan, now the vice presidential candidate, has repeatedly tried to write into federal law when he was trying to further restrict federal funding for abortion.
And he wrote a 1,500-word essay, Paul Ryan, on the subject with the eye-opening title of "The Cause of Life Can't Be Severed from the Cause of Freedom." So his reputation is one as an economic wonk. But he's been very much at the forefront of this effort to redefine rape, or I mean, it's all a part of this effort to make abortion more difficult.
Well, Ryan, I mean, look, Ryan's policy positions are basically indistinguishable from Todd Akin's. You know, Ryan believes that there should be no that abortion should be banned, and there should be no exception for rape and for rape or incest. Or health concerns. I think he believes that the only exemption he would be allowed it would be to save a woman's life. As a matter of fact, Paul Ryan has a 100% lifetime ranking by the national lifetime voting ranking by the National Right to Life Committee, and Todd Akin is actually a little bit worse than that by their accounting. There was one term during which he only scored 90%.
Boy, well, I'm sure he's made up for it now, though, hasn't he? But Michelle, you were just talking about this fellow Wilkie and his strange beliefs that have percolated into the mainstream thinking, and particularly have influenced Aiken and Ryan. How do they get around the fact that the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology tell us that 32,000 women conceive during rape every year?
Well, I'm pretty sure that Todd Aiken has never had occasion before this to pay any attention to the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. You know, so he's not really, basically this is kind of it was one of those received ideas that kind of percolates around the, the anti-abortion subculture, and that he probably never really gave that much thought to be honest, which is, one of the things that's so galling is this is a person who is presuming to make laws that are going to affect the lives of all American women, a person who sits on the House's Committee on Science, who it's not that he had kind of strong, well-founded beliefs. He just had this sort of vague idea that there was something he'd read once. And so, he's not standing by that anymore. He now admits, that women can become pregnant as a result of rape. And the idea that they can't is certainly not something that's integral to the anti-abortion movement, right? There's plenty of anti-abortion activists who go around the country lecturing about how they were products, that they were conceived in rape, and didn't they have a right to live?
Well, just to broaden this out a little, Michelle Goldberg, into obviously it's all in the context of the presidential race. And it would seem that if President Obama were to get the votes that he got in 2008, it would be a walk for him, and we wouldn't be having any kind of political discussions about this race, which for all, basically most of the punditry seem to think it's going to be quite close. It does seem that the people who are investing record amounts of money in the Romney campaign and the super PACs, and we are at a time in American life where millions of Americans who want to vote and who are eligible to vote and have voted before and who want to vote for a Democrat have to jump through hoops to prove who they are, whereas a handful of billionaires who are buying the election for the Republicans don't have to identify who they are. So we already have this bizarre, unlevel playing field, if you will. But it seems to me the strategy is spend unlimited amounts of money, suppress as many votes as you can, and perhaps we'll have a little foreign policy incident that might help us, and we'll win. The only thing that seems to be screwing up this game plan is the quality of the candidates themselves. Mitt Romney, who managed to go abroad and step in it with various gaffes. And, obviously Ryan is not responsible for this, but in a way, Todd Aiken and Ryan are indistinguishable. So it seems that given that Obama doesn't seem to have a clear message, except that the other guys are terrible, which is a...
I don't know. I would actually disagree with that. I think that Obama's running on a, that liberals don't give kind of Obama enough credit for the serious accomplishments of that, of his presidency. Obama is also running on the fact that he, unlike, any Democrat in modern history, has succeeded in at least starting the process of reforming our health system. He's running on the fact that he has done far more for gay and lesbians than any president in American history, that he has, done as much as he possibly can to provide some sort of relief for, immigrant kids who were brought here by their parents and are now, seeking to stay in the only country that they've ever known. So I would push back on the idea that he doesn't have a message.
Well, I recently had a conversation with Amitai Etzioni, who said that there was a focus group done, I think, by CNN recently where they had independent voters. And the assumption's always been that the center in this country ultimately decides. And this focus group was asked, what are the Republican talking points? And they could all recite them accurately and easily. But then when a question was asked, what are the Democratic talking points? There was a deathly silence. And even though I agree with you that Obama has accomplished a lot, I just don't get the impression that it seems to me that the people that hate him are so motivated and they're going to vote. And the people who voted for him last time, a lot of them seem to be disillusioned. And I'm just not sure how clear and simple the message is vis-a-vis what we hear from the Republicans.
I don't disagree with you that there might have been a failure of communication, but I would just argue that I would push back against the case that that's a problem of kind of, I think the problem is less substance than and more a problem of communication.
Well, there's no question that that the president has done as best as he can with what with what's been handed him, and the point
well,
I was
not just that he's done the best that he can. I think that it has kind of actually a fairly remarkable record of accomplishment.
So why are we even talking about it? Is it not clear, or is it just not clear to me?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, because there's absolutely no question that the economy is still catastrophic for a lot of people, and people are suffering enormously. And, you know, the message that it could have been a lot worse isn't one that any politician can really run on. And the message that here's all the things I would do if I didn't have a completely intransigent opposition, it, you know, also kind of only gets you so far. The other thing is that he's actually accomplished a great deal of what he said he was going to accomplish last time around. You know, I mean, think about what he ran on in 2008. He said he was going to reform healthcare, that he was going to try to bring the war in Iraq to a close, you know, that he was going to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He's done a lot of what he said he was going to do. The only kind of his challenge now is to turn the economy around. And the fact is there's almost... they've done about as much as they can do in the face of Republican opposition. They seem much less willing to spin out kind of pure fictions in the way that the Romney campaign has been.
But do you feel that there is a focus and activism on the right and not quite the same on the left? I mean,
oh yeah, certainly. I mean, yeah, I mean. Absolutely. You know, and part of that is just a function of it's always harder to get people excited about the status quo. You know, in a lot of ways, I'm reminded of 2000, in which, you know, I heard countless kind of progressives and Democrats, you know, whine about what a disappointment Al Gore was and kind of act as if, you know, it would barely matter if George W. Bush won the election, because how much worse could he really be? You know, it's amazing to me how quickly people forget that history. So, yeah, certainly the rage and the passion and that's all on the right. They see this, you know, this election as a kind of apocalyptic struggle for the future of their country. You know, again, it's very difficult, I think, to kind of muster a similar amount of passion about maintaining the unsatisfactory status quo.
Well, I think people should be passionate. I certainly feel really deeply offended and deeply angry about 5 million people being denied the vote. That mm-hmm. seems to be fundamentally un-American, and I also feel extremely disgusted with the hypocrisy, particularly of Mitt Romney, who portrays himself as a good Christian family man, and yet he is so deeply dishonest in the way he's been running his campaign, particularly his advertising. I mean, starting with the first one where he put John McCain's words in Obama's mouth, that's way back in Iowa, and the latest one with this total lie about waivers for
for welfare, yeah.
The welfare waivers, which is an absolute lie. I mean, it's mm-hmm. just outrageous that, so, you know, I would say that people on the left are kind of asleep if they don't recognize that they're being insulted here. And the ultimate insult, to my mind, is that this man won't release his taxes, either because he's hiding something or he's just plain arrogant.
I mean, I would actually say that there's something even more offensive about Romney than the fact that he won't release his taxes. I mean, I think there's two reasons for his attack on welfare. One is obviously just kind of racial demagoguery to convince people that, you know, Obama's kind of taking their money and giving it to shiftless, lazy people who don't want to work. But the other piece of it is that he is gearing up to launch, you know, the biggest kind of assault on the social safety net that we've ever seen. You know, kind of forget about his plans to turn Medicare into a voucher system. He wants to absolutely gut Medicaid. He wants to absolutely gut food stamps. You know, I mean, we're talking about 34% cuts. We're talking about, you know, kind of millions of people denied the only, you know, kind of paltry supports that our government provides them at the most kind of desperate moments of their lives. And so it's almost as if in order to do that, he has to kind of first convince people that the state has been overly generous to the poor, you know, when in fact poverty in this country is, you know, is a crisis. There's an enormous amount at stake. But part of the problem is that you were saying before that, you know, Obama has so far only been able to articulate, you know, how terrible the other guy is. And the fact is that actually is kind of a central issue in this election, is what exactly Romney plans to do to the poor and the middle class in this country.
Well, it seems that he's all about ambition without purpose. It's difficult to know why he's even running. He hasn't really made a case for what he's doing, and he's not exactly clear about what he's going to do, although I entirely agree with what you're saying is going to be the consequences. Just in closing, Michelle Goldberg, do you think then that the president is going to come out fighting here, in as much as the other side is already geared up and highly motivated, often by a kind of poisonous hatred? In his case, we've suggested that there's more of his record that can be touted, and he's being lucky in the sense that they keep wrong-footing themselves, and now instead of talking about the economy, they're talking about abortion. So is he going to continue to be lucky because the other side keeps stumbling, or do you think?
Well, you know, he is the luckiest. Obama is so consistently lucky in his political opponents, and this has been something that's, you know, a theme of his entire career, that, you know, if I actually did believe in this sort of thing, I would think that God wanted him to be president, because it, you know, the kind of the unforced errors of his opposition is just astonishing to watch.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, I say. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Michelle Goldberg.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Michelle Goldberg, who's a senior contributing writer for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and is the author of the New York Times bestseller Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, and The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, which was the winner of the 2008 J. Anthony Lucas Work in Progress Award and the Ernesta Drinker Ballard Book Prize. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg about Syria.
The moment that came because every sperm is sacred, every sperm is great. If a sperm is wasted, God gets quite irate.
Every sperm is